You're listening to Wake Up Tucson. This podcast is a Bustos Media production on The Voice. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Get here by no later than 3:45 to do that. So we got to get right back to the phones, calling in from Texas. A member here at the doing important work at the Biosphere is Greg Baron Gafford, Associate Professor, School of Geography and Development. Greg, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. How are y'all doing?
Not too bad. Sounds like you're having a heck of a time in beautiful, the great state of Texas.
Yeah, well, they've gotten plenty of rain here, so I've been trying to push it west.
Thank you. We're praying for that right now. So let's talk about what you're doing. You are I keep seeing, as I was going through your work today, I keep seeing the word biogeography. Let's talk about biogeography.
Biogeography is kind of a complicated way of saying we study how plants work around the planet. And you know, there's deserts all over the world, but our Sonoran Desert's a unique one. You know, what makes it unique? What creates the deserts where they are on the landscape? And what kind of forces are different in those places? You know, not everyone has saguaros, so why is that? That's the sort of thing we talk about when we're studying biogeography. What's where on the planet, and why, and how do we keep it the way we want it?
So, what is your journey to this part of your career? Where did you start off with? When did this interest in bioscience grab you, and how did that career develop a little bit?
This is a question I get all the time, especially from my parents.
They wanted you to be a CPA, Greg. That's what happened.
Or a doctor. Yeah. So I was super interested in science as a kid. Really liked biology, but I was also at the same time working at a grocery store throughout high school. And at one point, cut my hand open on one of those vents, the filters that go into our air conditioning vents. Loading it into a person's car, and that's when I saw my own blood and passed out in the parking lot, and it became very apparent that a doctor's route was not for me, at least not a traditional doctor. So now I cut open plants and study plants. They don't bleed the same, and so apparently I'm not affected the same, and so can work with them. So I had this idea that I really liked science. I really liked studying the environment and how it created the places around the globe that we love to explore. But it wasn't in the cards for me to be a traditional medical doctor. So, yeah, I'm a plant doctor.
So as you were younger, when you were younger, and you said that started the science bug started by, what were some of the influences of why at a young age? Was it a teacher? What was it?
Yeah, I think it was a combination of things. One, my grandparents have a ranch out in Texas, which is where I'm at right now.
Right.
And so it was a lot of outside time. Grandparents sent you outside, at least back then. We'll see you in a few hours. Go entertain yourself. And to see just how amazing the natural world is, how plants and insects and everything work together to create the kind of complex but beautifully synchronized ecosystems that we have, just how everything worked well. And so many of the ways that my grandfather would engineer things up was based on some of his own observations, just watching the natural world, watching people. I became more of just an observer, and combining that with trying to study up on the sciences because I thought I'd be a doctor. But I did have a teacher who taught environmental science. Usually it's the last chapter in the biology textbook, but she brought it forward and really helped us think about the environment and how delicate it is, and how amazing it is, and it really ran from there.
I love the idea of combining the science with your grandfather's just observations of what's going on in the world. I love that combination.
Yeah, hopefully kids, we try to do it ourselves, but our own kids love screen time, but you got to get them to look up instead of down, get them to look out there at the world. And a lot of times you just kind of engage them a little bit, and that natural curiosity that all of us have will take over. So That's part of what we do at the Biosphere and the way we connect the Biosphere down to some of the TUSD schools in the area is taking kids outside and helping. They actually help us with some of the observations that they're doing, help us with their actual science. And in addition to giving them data to work with in the classroom, I feel like a lot of what we're doing is just getting them outside, being observers, and helping them recognize that everyone has this capacity. It's not something they lack. It's really in there. They've just be sometimes I've been stuck inside too much.
Well, see, that's the multi-pronged benefits of all this, right? So you're saying, look, they're helping you out, right? There's a pay it forward, get the next generation involved in this kind of thing, and the idea that if they're out looking at plants, dirt, or whatever you have them working, that's an extra 90 minutes not looking at their stupid Instagram page. Nothing against Instagram.
Exactly.
But
yeah, no. In case they're a sponsor, it's absolutely true. And sometimes when they're doing the math work in their classroom, it's just a worksheet, and you know, people come up with the science standards and everything that help test the kids and make sure the kids are on the right page. But sometimes the kids aren't engaged with that worksheet. But if they're outside counting, you know, germination rates from some of our experiments we have going on, not at the Biosphere, but at some of their schools, and they take that data back to the classroom, and you get a lot more attention span that comes when they collected the data versus a worksheet that they don't really get the background of.
Can I ask you to hold on just for a few minutes for some commercials, please, Greg?
Sure.
Awesome. We're hanging out with Greg Baron Gafford. He's calling in from Texas, the grandparents' ranch where it all started. And we're going to be talking about his work here at the Biosphere 2 in biogeography and what's on his plate for the next, you know, the near future of what he's working on. If you have a question, 790-2040, wakeuptucsoncomments@gmail.com. We are live at Biosphere 2. Please join us. Wake up.
Well, gosh, I hope he's still there. Greg. I've got him on.
Oh, yeah, I hear you.
There you are.
Hey,
thank
Greg.
You,
how
good
are
morning,
you, sir?
Good, thanks.
All right. Right now, we, you know, talking to Aaron and Katie about what they're working on. What is currently right in front of you that you're currently working on in relation to your Biosphere work?
Right. So I moved out to the Biosphere from Texas in 2001, and so I've got to be in and around the Biosphere for a while now. What we've got going on right now is a cool project where we're trying to think about how to get the most out of our lands. So a lot of us want renewable energy added to part of our energy portfolio. You know, we don't want to be so dependent on other countries for some of our resources. And if we want to put solar panels up, where do we put these? You know, putting them on our houses is excellent. It does a lot of great benefits in terms of offsetting some of that energy input. But to really do it at a bigger scale, you need to put these large solar farms out there. And then the challenge becomes, where do you put that? Usually that's on the edges of cities, the peri-urban area, we call it. And unfortunately, that's where a lot of the farming already is happening. And so how do you use our land for not just food production and not just energy production, but for both? And does that make any sense? And so that's what we've been doing. The Elvis music you had playing between some of your segments, a little less talk and a little more action, that's what we're trying to do, is put a lot of these things we've been hearing about into action. You know, we know that plants, anybody who's growing tomatoes through the summer in our Tucson heat knows that they don't like it. And anybody who's trying to garden right now knows it's tough, and the only way we can do so much food production that we do is because we use a lot of water to make that happen. But another thing we all know is, just imagine if you spilled your water bottle in the shade of, like, say, your carport versus the sunny area of your yard. Which one's going to stay wet longer? The shady area, right? And so we started to think, well, what if you actually grow the plants in the shade of your solar panels? Could you save water in that way? But the flip side is, can plants even grow in that level of shade? And so we decided to do an experiment, coming back to, you know, my childhood. Yeah, these observations, plants grow in the shade all the time. Think about our mesquite trees that, you know, act as nurse trees for saguaro and so many other plants underneath. So maybe you can grow plants in shade. You're under a carport. It's not dark. You know, we've got so much light in Arizona, just an overabundance of light. And so we thought maybe we could give these plants a little bit of stress relief, not being in so much full sun. And so that's what we've been studying, is how can you produce food under solar arrays and still get really good production, even better production in some cases, because the plants aren't as stressed out.
In relation to, if I'm in the biosphere as we're doing the tour later today, I assume I'm going to see a mini version of that large scale, what you want to do here?
Yes. So you won't see it inside the biosphere, but you'll see it at the last stop of your tour outside of the biosphere. So this is another cool thing about the biosphere. For the public, it's this really great opportunity to travel all around the world. I mean, where else can you drive for an hour from Tucson and visit a rainforest, go by the ocean, hang out in the desert that's a cooler desert, and learn at the same time? And so people will make that route through these cool different biomes from around the world, hearing about how these places, you know, are under different kinds of pressures from, you know, we really need a lot from our ecosystem. And taking all those clues that you've been learning about, like, you know, how important water is, how important this is, how important that is, how plants are sensitive to this. And then you end at this exhibit, which we call agrivoltaics. It's a mashup word of agriculture and photovoltaics, which is what solar panels are. And so we've just smashed those words together, because basically we're just smashing those land uses together. And that's the last stop on the tour.
It's so funny, after talking to Aaron in the last hour and listening to you talk about clues, right? I actually did an interview with an author. The book, I've read it. It's sitting on my it's one of the books I have not traded in or anything. It's called How to Read Water. It's by a guy named Tristan Gooley. It's called Clues and Patterns from Puddles to the Sea. And I'm sitting there going, after listening to you and Aaron, I'm like, I got to go back and read that book now.
Yeah, that's what's driving so much of our observation right into the discovery of what's next. I mean, the idea that you would put solar panels and food production together just is like, why? And it's not until you realize that this couldn't just be a solution for, you know, development, like keeping the land, you know, doing most for you, but it's actually good for plants. You know, this observation that sometimes plants need a little protection from the sun. You know, mesquites can handle it, but other plants can't. So why not recreate a nurse tree situation, which is basically what we've done. We've got solar panels that are like the mesquite canopy overstory, and food production underneath where they're protected from that hot 110 kind of sun like you're going to have today, because they don't like it. They don't like it at all.
So if you feel as though as you have those positive results from what you're doing here, what would be the next stage of that of this to go, you know, I assume to do it bigger someplace else with someone who's really doing food production, correct?
Yes. Yeah. So we've got a couple of different ways we're running with this. So now that we've got some good results and good demonstration up there at the Biosphere 2 site, we've brought it into town. And so, as I mentioned before, we use it as an educational tool, because so many TUSD schools have solar. And then another great thing is not everybody likes to listen to professor types, so
right.
Hopefully your ratings are okay today, but they love hearing kids talk about things, and so the kids are just as much advocates for this kind of new approach as we are. They see the results too. They eat the results in their school cafeteria, where they get to take the tomatoes and the basil back to the cafeteria. And so they're going to be able to tell their parents about it. We're also, what I was doing in the hour before talking to you all, is a grant proposal that we're writing with folks from Illinois, where they do large scale farming, right? And so what are some of the challenges that we already experience in the Southwest in terms of growing food in a hot and somewhat dry climate? You know, and that's some of the projections for the Midwest. It's going to be hotter. So can they continue their business as usual, or do they have to start to take clues from other places around the globe? And because we're producing food in a drier, hotter land, they're looking towards us for how we've approached that.
I kind of feel like you're the next future stage of the City of Gastronomy designation by UNESCO, because the guts of that whole idea is that we've been growing food in a hostile environment for you know, several hundred to a couple of thousand years, and I feel like maybe you're the next stage of that.
Oh, that'd be fun. That'd be a good honor. But you've really pointed something out is every time you think you've done something new, you can look back far enough and you can find a clue for that too, a clue from that puddle. I mean, yeah, we have the long-term people living here in Tucson because, you know, 4,000 years ago, they were growing food here. You know, they're using the Santa Cruz for food production. And when we do some of our undergraduate programs, which we try to recruit a lot of folks from native populations, and they'll say, oh, that's how my great-grandparents have been growing food under the shade of the mesquite tree. You're like,
correct.
Huh. Yeah. We are basically replicating something that's been happening here for generations, but the slight tweak is what that overstory is.
It's the tweaking of the tweaking from. The wisdom of the elders.
Exactly. Wow, I should run with that.
Yeah, just give me a penny for every time you use it. So,
okay.
Hey, Greg, thanks for calling in. I appreciate you. I know you're having weather situations in Texas, so I appreciate the calling.
All right. Thanks for getting the word out about what we do up there.
You got it, buddy. Thank you. We'll talk again.
Okay, bye.
That's Greg Baron Gafford calling in from his grandparents' ranch in Texas. We got Laura Meredith coming up next. She got here nice and early. She's the director of research here at the Biosphere 2 Rainforest, and we'll talk about her research coming up next. If you have a question or comment, 790-2040, wakeuptucsoncomments@gmail.com. I look forward to seeing all of you that are think you're coming around the 9 o'clock hour for the first tour. Can't wait to see you. And again, remember the special rate for Wake Up Tucson listeners is extended through the end of the day. So if you can't make it right away, please join us later. It's the perfect day to get out of the heat and hang out and find out all the good work they're doing here. So Ed, spin us away. You're on Wake Up Tucson, 10:30, KBOI The Voice, local news and talk.
It was on this date, 1969, Buzz Aldrin, Michael Collins, Neil Armstrong lifted off on top of a Saturn V rocket from Kennedy Space Center in Florida on their way to the moon, baby. We're in Biosphere 2 today with Wake Up Tucson.
All right. Welcome back to Wake Up Tucson. We're at the Biosphere 2 doing our live remote world groundbreaking live remote, as we say here at Wake Up Tucson. Ed Alexander, you doing okay over there?
Doing all right. Okay. All right. Wish I was there.
I wish you were here too.
Yep.
So
bingo.
We'll take you up there. We'll take you one day. I promise.
Love it up there. Love it.
So we're hanging out in beautiful Oracle, Arizona. Please join us. The place, last tour is 4:15 today, and John and Joaquin have offered an amazing, the cat card rate for students and faculty for all the listeners. It's only $11 to come in and do the tour. Instead of blowing $8 to take your kid to see that lousy Lion King movie today, why don't you bring them up to the Biosphere? So, and we are basically, if you have a question or comment, 790-2040. We're hanging out with Laura Meredith. She's the Director of Research, Biosphere 2 Rainforest. Good morning and welcome.
Morning. Thank you.
How are you?
I'm good. Yeah.
A little closer to that microphone, please.
Okay,
I'm
going
to make you hunch over on that thing. I apologize.
No problem.
You just got here 4 years ago.
I did. Yeah, I came to Tucson and University of Arizona as a postdoc 4 years ago, and I was really fortunate to land one of the faculty positions here at the university. So I've been a faculty member for 2.5 years and heavily involved in Biosphere 2 research ever since.
Where are you originally from?
From Oregon.
Okay.
Yeah, Southern Oregon. A different kind of forest than I work on here.
Right. And so I asked somebody, everyone today, when did the science bug first hit? Laura Meredith.
Yeah, I think the science bug hit me pretty young. I mean, I spent a lot of time in Southern Oregon in the woods growing up, observing nature. I remember, I was a fairly serious child in some ways. I remember excavating. I found a cow skeleton in our property, and I excavated it as an archaeologist would in a very careful manner, and
very nice.
Labeled everything. I think I may have even made a spreadsheet. So I think this might have been an early bug.
Did you have any science teachers in the early days that were really influential? It's for you to say.
Yeah, I did. I had a lot of great science teachers and experiences, some sort of hands-on creative experiences in elementary school and middle school, some really great computer scientist teachers in high school. And I think all along the way, I've had a lot of access to some interesting questions out there and science teachers, and it's nice to be a part of Biosphere 2 and kind of provide that access point, you know, for other students who are growing up.
So leading up to this director of research doing rainforest, what was your work leading up to this involved with?
Yeah, so I started in the atmosphere. I started sort of large scale. I studied chemistry in undergrad and was really interested in how atmospheric chemistry plays a role in the air quality that we all live in and breathe, and also how it plays a role in climate. And as I was studying atmospheric chemistry, I became really interested in how powerful the smallest of creatures, microorganisms, are in controlling the composition of our atmosphere. So microbes are kind of like the original atmospheric engineers. They invented a way to create a bunch of oxygen and changed our atmosphere to the one we have today. And so as I learned about the role of microbes on the atmosphere, I got more and more interested in them. And soils are a massive reservoir of microbial life. And so then I became interested in soil microbes and how they drive atmospheric composition. And so really my research is trying to use genomic tools to understand microbial life in soils and link that to the ways that we measure atmospheric gases. So sort of bridging two different disciplines. And so that was my original research, and that's something that you can really do in a powerful way under the glass in Biosphere 2.
Well, and kind of it's the it's really part of the basics of what leads kind of affects everything else that maybe other people are studying here, correct?
Yeah. I think that's one thing that I've learned in my work and that we really demonstrate here is how interconnected Earth systems are, and you really can't study things in a complete way from any one angle. I mean, you can't just look at the microbiology or just look at the atmosphere or the hydrology. We really need to take a lot of different disciplines and angles into account to understand how a whole ecosystem works.
We're talking to Laura Meredith, and you can also look at lauramerredith.com. Which you have a lot of, let me say a scientific term, there's a lot of stuff on lauramerredith.com.
Try to put some interesting things up there, yeah.
And again, she is the Director of Research for Biosphere 2 on the rainforest. So when our folks come today and they go to the rainforest section of Biosphere 2, what are they going to experience? And then we'll talk about, as we move through here, how are you going to be working in there, especially a big project coming in the fall. But let's, when they get there, what are they going to experience?
So when you come to the tour at Biosphere 2, you'll sort of open this door into the rainforest biome and be hit initially with just a completely different climate. You know, you'll feel the humidity, you'll feel the forest, you'll smell the fragrances of the tropical forest as soon as you enter the biome, and then you'll look out on a vista. We have a mountain and lots of, you know, really nice tropical plants. There was a waterfall, but actually in preparation for this experiment, we've turned the waterfall off for the time being. I can explain that more in a second.
Sure.
But you'll come out and you'll see some scientists working. We have scientists from the University of Arizona, colleagues from Germany, and a lot of really great summer students who are helping us do research in the rainforest. And so I actually just installed a whiteboard yesterday that says today's scientists, and so it lists the names of the people who are working, and then today's science, what they're actually working on.
It's like
on.
When I go to the zoo and they say this is the kind of bear that's out there, you're going to tell me what kind of scientist is out working in the...
Yeah, we there are wild animals out there, and we want to remove any questions. So we're trying to, you know, you see somebody with like a chamber or some sort of apparatus, and it's not always clear what they're doing. So we're trying to sort of let people know what those activities are.
What is the technical definition of rainforest? What makes it a rainforest?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm not sure if I actually know the climatological statistics, but I think it's about the amount of rain. It's about for a tropical rainforest, it's about the climate. And so that's something that we're replicating here in terms of this is actually the hottest tropical rainforest in the world. So we're, you know, in Arizona pushing the spectrum of the types of temperatures that are usually reached in the tropics. And we also try to maintain the type of humidity in a wet rainforest system that would accompany those temperatures.
So I remember 15, 20 years ago, I think it was Sting, you know, was always trying to save the rainforest and in South America, because there was clear cutting going on. And what is the status of that? Is the rainforest and the big one, right? Is the one in South America, I assume, right?
Yeah, I mean, like the Brazilian rainforest, our African rainforest. I mean,
what is the status of that rainforest?
In the Amazon, so deforestation has the rate of deforestation has slowed, but it's certainly not stopped.
Right.
And so there's still a lot of conversion to agricultural land use, and that was something that was actually the project that I came to Arizona to work on, was with some colleagues in the ecology department who are studying the consequence of the continued conversion of, you know, old growth rainforest to pasture or to cropland, and seeing how that changes the gas fluxes, how the soils react to that type of change. But then they're also looking at some of the areas that, after being used for agriculture, are regrowing. They're regrowing into secondary forest, but they look very different from the original forest. So then are those processes in the soil recovering?
Sure.
So I mean, there are a lot of really interesting questions we still don't know scientifically, but certainly those types of land use change are still happening.
In the rainforest here, what is the fauna side in there? Is there any?
We have some insects and nematodes. Every once in a while, a bird gets in.
Native to the rainforest bird?
No. but actually, very interestingly, we've started to survey the microorganisms in the rainforest, and we found, for example, there, my colleague Jana Uren, who's a professor in biosystems engineering here, she's been studying the microbial communities that live inside and on top of, and she's actually cultured some of the microbes from inside of these leaves, and they are very close relatives to ones that are found in Panama, that are found in other tropical systems. So you could say that our fauna is just the small ones, you know. They're like the worms and microbes, things that you don't see, but there is life in there that reflects the tropical forest.
So when you were younger, people said, Laura, when you're older, your favorite animal is going to be a microbe.
Mm-hmm.
You would have said, really?
I think I would have. Yeah, I also didn't even like microbiology in undergrad. I really disliked the class. It was interesting. But what I found with research is when you're interested in a question, and you need to learn a different discipline, a different science to answer that question, suddenly that becomes really interesting. So I think in terms of being turned on or off to different disciplines, like if you get engaged in an interesting question, you can like any discipline. So yeah, now I love microbes, but I never would have known that.
I had a girlfriend in college who was taking her microbiology class, and I think it mentally scarred her for
when you culture things from your own mouth, you know, you get...
And then, of course, what was happening, I was taking a degree in business hotel restaurant management, right? Mm-hmm. And she's doing microbiology, right? And so when it came time to return our books to get some trade at the end of... They would take mine but never take hers because, of course, someone changed the amount of cilia on a paramecium something.
Yeah.
And they said, you know, your book's out of...
Yeah, it's a fast-moving field. It still is, especially.
She's like, I paid $105 bucks for this book.
All the sequencing technologies now too. Yeah, things are moving quickly.
All right, we're going to take a break, and then we'll come back. And you have an amazing, exciting thing. This is like the Super Bowl of rainforests, contained rainforest experiments coming up this fall. So we're going to talk to. Remember, you got to check out, her name is Laura Meredith. Go to lauramerdith.com. There is she has a lot of her research on there and all the different things and publications that she has worked on over the years. So we'll do one more segment with her. Ed, let's go to Suzanne in Texas real quick. Tennessee. Are you there, Ed?
I am.
Oh, there she is. Suzanne, good morning. How are you doing?
Good morning. I'm good. How are you?
Not too bad. The first day we get to talk together, I'm up at the Biosphere 2 in the northern part of the Catalina Mountains, hanging out talking to amazing scientists. And here you are calling from Tennessee about Calitren. Right. How are you doing?
I am doing great. Yes, we're in Tennessee. We're wet right now. We have lots of rain.
That's what I love about her. You can tell she's from Tennessee just from that beautiful accent.
I know.
You're like, accent? What are you talking about? So let's talk to everyone real quick. I just started over the last couple of months taking this Calitren, and basically it's been something that as I'm working out, working on the bike and things like that, getting back into shape, energy is pretty good. I can see as our first time out, what is in a Calitren? How about that?
Calitren is collagen. You know, it's we're born with collagen, we lose it, so you're putting back into your body what your body had naturally. And it's not your fast overnight weight loss, but it's your healthy way. It's one of your few that has absolutely no drugs, no stimulants, doesn't interact with any medications, no matter what you're taking. I've had open heart surgery. I've been on it for over 15 years because I take it for the arthritis. There's lots of benefits like the joint pain, the sleep, the acid reflux benefits, but no side effects whatsoever.
So how do the good folks find out more? I know you guys have a lot of testimonials. How do the Wake Up Tucson listeners find out about it?
Look at our website. It's toploss.com. We have our summer sizzle sale going on right now. It's toploss.com, or you can give us a call at 1-800-325-4366.
Awesome. All right. Well, I think we had our first good one for our talks together, and I appreciate you calling in from the great state of Tennessee.
All right. You have a great day.
You too, Suzanne. Take care.
Thanks.
That's Calitran. Go to. I've taken it. I've had no weird side effects. It's been pretty good. Like I said, energy wise, in the afternoon, I'm definitely drinking that iced coffee I usually have at 1 o'clock. I'm doing less iced coffees. It feels a little more natural on the energy side. So check out toploss.com. Ed Alexander, spin us away. You're on Wake Up Tucson, 10:30 KVY The Voice, local news and talk. Ian Ballou, you're unbelievable, Ed Alexander. Good job, buddy. That's why he's a Hall of Famer.
Phone call.
Phone call from the moon, believe it or not, by Adrian Ballou. 7902040. Is that on one of your lists that you have?
Yeah, one of your past lists, yeah.
What's the subject on the list that you're pulling it from?
Space.
Space.
Phone call from the moon. I mean, hey, you know.
You're the man, Ed Alexander. Hey, we're having a great time here at Biosphere 2. And again, we're introducing you to the scholars, scientists who are doing some really important work here. And as you're finding out, all these cool different backgrounds of people like Katie, who are from Tucson, who went to Cat Foothills and U of A, and then kind of moved on through there, to all these people coming from other parts of the country. And then what we're all finding out, the common thread is when they were young, that of them had an outdoor natural experience, right? So, Laura's here. Laura Meredith, you were excavating cow skeletons in the forests of Oregon. Mm-hmm. Aaron was up in the Pacific Northwest himself and then hanging out with huskies in Alaska. Katie was a Florida beach girl. And then there was probably some science teacher in your life that said, hey, this is a really cool thing to do and move, and this could be your life's work. And look at you guys. You're at a great level right now. So congratulations, and don't get too confident and keep working. So can I say, is it VALD?
Yeah, VALD. Yeah.
WALD.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is the Super Bowl of self-contained rainforest experiments going on with lots of folks from Germany.
Mm-hmm.
October, you said?
We're starting in September.
Oh, okay.
And the preparations are underway right now.
So let's go back to, you're going to disappoint our tour people today because you shut off the waterfall.
I assume
this is part of preparing for VALD?
This is part of preparing for VALD, yeah. So VALD stands for Water, Atmosphere, and Life Dynamics. And the reason that we picked VALD as the acronym is, in German, it means forest.
Sure.
And so it's sort of appropriate for the Biosphere 2 tropical rainforest. And the point of this experiment is to use the power of Biosphere 2 as a place to run experiments on whole ecosystems. We really don't have a lot of facilities in the country or in the world where we have an ecosystem in a controlled environment where we can kind of pull different levers and see what it does, how the whole ecosystem responds. A lot of experimentation happens like in pots, you know, in a greenhouse or in a petri dish,
right,
or where you have really controlled conditions, but it doesn't really represent all of the complexum. Or there's a lot of really valuable, you know, work that happens by observing the natural world. But in that case, you can't just say, I want a drought.
Right.
I want to observe a drought and see what happens. You kind of have to just wait for Mother Nature to create the conditions and then describe what you see. And so the ecosystems at Biosphere 2 are these great experimental facilities where we can just say, we're going to run a controlled drought. We know exactly when it's going to happen. We decide
right.
exactly how long it happens. And then we can actually use the glass structure to do some other neat things, like adding isotopic tracers and really use it to do unique types of science. So that's what we're going to do in this VALD campaign. And we are collaborating with a lot of folks from Europe, from Germany, Austria, Switzerland, Scotland, and they are really interested in a lot of different questions in ecosystem science, and so they've been shipping equipment over. People are starting to come over, and we've just built this really massive collaboration in the Biosphere 2 rainforest to study how this rainforest is going to respond to drought, how it's carbon cycling is going to change, how the water cycling is going to change, and really understanding how interactions between plants and microbes and soil happen on a really detailed level. So we've brought in all the experts, you know, to look at all the different angles, and we're really excited to get going on this experiment.
What is an area of the Earth, rainforest-wise, that has the most recent drought that seems pretty substantial?
Well, there was like some El Nino events a few years ago now, but I know that there was really our colleagues that were working there in the Amazon. I think this was like 2016, had this massive rush because all of a sudden, you know, the forecasts and everything was aligning, and it's like, okay, this is a massive drought in the Amazon, and we need funding, and we need to just go there and observe it as fast as possible. And so they made some really, you know, valuable observations, but again, it was like wait and see what nature throws at you and try to be prepared in the moment. And that's a massive challenge, you know, because it takes time to plan and to be in place to do those observations.
Well, then of course, having the, you know, the government timely fund things is always an interesting thing too.
Yeah, and I mean, luckily there are some rapid funding mechanisms for just this topic,
right.
But still it's, yeah, things take time, you know, it needs to go through.
So it's almost a feeling like a couple of them got there, felt like they got there a little too late.
I'm sure.
Right.
Yeah. And so here we just get to be prepared. I mean, we still feel like we're rushing. We've got a ton of preparation to do. I think we have like 17 gas analyzers. We're going to have, you know, tons of instrumentation inside of the rainforest to monitor the atmosphere and monitor the soils, monitor the plants. And so we, you know, we're bringing this together in a really rapid way for us. But we've known for a year that this is going to happen. And so even a year seems like a rush to us.
So the shutting off the waterfall is part of the droughting of this area. But when does so what other factors are right now occurring to start emulating a drought?
Right. So what we are trying to emulate right now is still kind of a control condition. We want the system to be well hydrated and under its business as usual conditions. The turning off the waterfall was just to remove the standing water, so we didn't have to wait for that to dry down too.
Gotcha.
So the first part of this experiment is we want a control period. We want to measure how the ecosystem is functioning in its sort of healthy, hydrated condition, and then we'll turn off the water.
Gotcha.
Turn off the rain. We just stop raining, and we'll watch the system dry down. We'll observe how the microbes and the plants are changing their activity and response. And we're going to actually use the facility for a really neat aspect when we re-wet, is we'll actually re-wet from the bottom up. So the whole biosphere 2 is lined by steel and concrete, even the bottom. And so
they didn't want the original biospherians digging out. That's why they did that.
That might be true. I don't think anyone is going to try to dig in. So we can actually add water at the bottom of the ecosystem and know that it's going to stay there.
Gotcha.
And we can answer these questions that are really cutting edge about where plants get their water from. And there's a lot of evidence that plants, trees can get water from deep layers and actually bring it up through the root system and redistribute to the upper layers of soil, sort of sharing with their friends who don't have such deep roots. And so we can test that really precisely here by adding the water at the depth, adding an isotopic tracer that helps us know specifically that it came from that water pool.
Sure.
And we know that that water isn't going to just seep down into the lower ground levels, which is the problem in natural experimentation.
So my last question before we run out of time is, how long is the drought in this Vald experience going to occur?
So Vald will go until December.
Okay.
And so the drought will be for a couple months. We're hoping to have some nice interactive features for visitors to understand where we are with the process and what's going on. It's really science happening right before your eyes if you come and check us out. And it's going to